NPR Music is celebrating 10 years, and we're looking back on some moments and memories. I'm here with Jacob Gans, Lars Gotrichsen in Beacon, New York, Nate Chenin. Hello, everybody.
Hi, hey, Bob.
Hi. Do you remember VCRs? Do you remember listening to CDs? Let's listen to the XX a little bit. We'll talk about 2009. I remember playing this for Rob and Hilton, and he just felt like they were so restrained, and it was just awful. He just wanted to let them loose. He felt that it was so, constrained and restrained and
quiet.
Yeah, and quiet, yeah.
Yeah.
I was so resistant to this band when they came out in 2009, because I was definitely very much more in my screamy punk and metal phase, but like writing about the XX's album from this year, some of the singles that have come out for our website, I started listening back to the XX and I'm like, oh wait, I actually really like this.
They were really, really good. I saw them as a four-piece in New York in 2009. They went down to a three-piece, which is Rami Madley Croft and Oliver Sim. And then Jamie Smith, also Jamie XX, is how he became more known as.
Yeah, and less quiet as Jamie XX.
Very much so. It was a good year for that sort of music, too. Not just quiet music, but music made by artists on smaller labels.
It was a huge year for artists who are on smaller labels. I mean, some of the biggest records of the year in terms of critical praise anyway, the Animal Collective record, Meriwether Post Pavilion, the Grizzly Bear record, Vecatimist, the Dirty Projectors record, Bitte Orca.
Right. Nate, you had seen Dirty Projectors, in fact, in New York City, right, that year?
Yeah, I was thinking about the fact that, to me, when I look back at 2009, it was a really big year for sonically adventurous indie rock bands, you know, and those albums that Jacob just mentioned.
So you saw Dirty Projectors, right, in New York City?
Yes, I saw them in a special show with Bjork at the Housing Works bookshop in Soho. And this was the premiere of some material that Dave Longstreth had written for Bjork that became their Mount Wittenberg Orca EP. And, you know, it was one of those nights. I was standing on a balcony above the stage next to David Byrne. And, you know, that was the night that he met Annie Clark, a.k.a. St. Vincent. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of one of those stars aligning kind of evenings.
It could only have happened in 2009.
We presented Dirty Projectors that year at South by Southwest at a place called The Parish that year. Also,
that band live was amazing.
Yeah, very much so. That was a good year for jazz, and that's one of the reasons why we wanted you so much to be here, Nate.
It definitely was. There were a bunch of terrific albums that year, and I think the one that stands out in retrospect is Historicity, which was the debut studio album of the Vijay Iyer Trio. Vijay had released a lot of great albums before this one, but this was where he really stepped out with the trio. This is featuring Stefan Crump on bass and Marcus Gilmore on drums. And this band is still very much a working band and an important one. But this album, I think a lot of people took notice.
It's an album that takes an awful lot of directions here. We start, one of the cuts on the record was a cut, Doggone AD, which was my favorite Julius Hempel song of on planet Earth, written probably around the time Vijay was born, like, the early 70s, right? And then we're in talking about all this independent rock stuff that's going on. There was an MIA cut.
Right, he did a version of Galang, which is just fantastic, you know, and really sort of cuts to the heart of the sort of rhythmic energy of the song. It's an acoustic jazz piano trio cut, but it feels like riotous and explosive in exactly the same way that her version does.
The first time I heard that song, actually, it's funny that you mentioned that that it has that exact same energy as the original MIA song, Nate, because the first time I heard that Vijay Iyer recording was a mashup that the writer Wayne Marshall, who blogged as Wayne and Wax back right. in those days, he made of the vocals from the MIA song with over the Vijay Iyer trio cut,
this.
And he just called it Galangs, which was, I mean, it is that. I mean, it is the two things added together and just as exciting as you would expect from like all of those clashes coming together and actually just like one recording it. That was a really nice moment.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and there are other covers on this album. You know, he does Mystic Brew, the Ronnie Foster tune that people knew, you know, from hip hop. He does Stevie Wonder, and he does Somewhere by Leonard Bernstein. It all feels really contemporary. It all feels like he's really thought about the translation process. And then the rhythmic energy of this trio is completely unique and has been super influential.
I'm going to say that so far we've done 2007, 8, and 9, and I think I feel like being back in 2009 most of all. It feels really good.
It's a good one.
Let's take a quick break. I'm here with Nate Chinnin, Jacob Gans, and Laura Scott-Ridge. We're talking about some memories from 2009.
Support for NPR Music's 10th anniversary and the following message come from iZotope, makers of Spire Studio, the portable multi-track recording system that lets you easily capture, mix, and edit professional quality songs wherever and whenever inspiration strikes. With built-in Wi-Fi, Spire Studio seamlessly connects to the Spire app, so you can ditch the cables to collaborate and share with bandmates and fans around town or around the world. Learn more at spire.live.
We're talking about 2009 as NPR Music celebrates its 10th anniversary. We had great music in 2009, but also we had some sad news with the death of Michael Jackson.
Yeah, Michael Jackson died in July of 2009. I remember I wasn't working for NPR Music yet, but I was working at NPR's bureau in New York the day that this happened. And it was just, you could hear the news cascade through the newsroom. It was such a shock to people. By that time, I think the way that we had thought of Michael Jackson had gotten really complicated. The scandals with, you know, boys accusing him of inappropriate behavior, many of which were settled or dismissed. His sort of like long return. He was rehearsing for a many night run at a huge London concert hall when he died. And people didn't quite think of him as the icon that he had been during the 1980s and even the early 90s before, you know, grunge famously swept over the pop landscape. But this was a moment for me that you just saw this generation of people who had never gotten to think of him as an uncomplicated figure, just appreciate his music, stop and listen to his music and grieve for the talent that was lost. It also was this one of the first major deaths of the social media era. I remember just people sharing memories of him very immediately and extensively. And it felt like that mourning process went on for weeks and sort of confirmed that a new era of pop stars had become elders, had become like the, had earned classic status in a way that they, it, we didn't know that they had gotten to that point in 2009. And then, you know, we know now that the next 8 years have just been confirmation of that with death after death after death.
Maybe you're implying this, but the generation seeing their first major death.
Yeah, I think that it right. was, you know, it was both people who were growing up as I was when Michael Jackson was at the height of his fame, and also people who were a little bit younger who had never known him as anything other than somebody who, you know, who was maybe in the news for other things other than just his music. We thought of classic rock or the classic pop era as being sort of the Beatles and Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones. And then Michael Jackson dies and you realize that there are people who have grown up thinking of Michael Jackson as the fabric of pop music. And really, this was their first chance to celebrate him and his music in this just sort of straightforwardly appreciative way.
I have a very quick story that I think, I love what you said, Jacob, about that sort of clash between image and music. And my experience of the evening of that news really sort of mirrors that. I was assigned to review a jazz trio that night. It was a gig at the Iridium Jazz Club, which is in Times Square. So, you know, I got the news and I was reeling and I was still processing it. And I started walking through Times Square to get to this club, you know, where I was going to see this trio. I walked right by Madame Tussauds wax museum, and they had wheeled out the Michael Jackson wax figure and put it in the window, garlanded with flowers and things. Wow. And it was this crazy, macabre, surreal image, you know, tourists just thronged on the sidewalk taking pictures of this wax figure of, you know, Thriller era Michael Jackson with the mirrored, you know, sunglasses and the epaulettes. And it was just weird. It just felt really creepy, right? So I walk past that and kind of feel strange about it. And then I get into the club. It's the Jackie Terrison trio. And the set begins and he's playing, you know, this, you know, really sort of spectacular, these tremolos on the piano. And then the groove that emerges is Beat It. And he's playing it, you know, with an acoustic piano trio. And there was nothing about it that felt arch or sort of winking or semi-serious. It was an elegy, but it was also this, like, you know, rhythmic miracle. It was an unbelievable tribute. It felt so emotional. And in a way, it kind of swept away all of the Madame Tussauds, and it just brought me right back into the, you know, the genius of the music. That's my Michael Jackson evening of death memory.
Awesome. The end of the year brought a very talented guitarist. Can I play one tune?
Yeah, go ahead.
And let me play this by Jack Rose.
So on December 5th, 2009, Jack Rose died. And I still think about him every week.
Wow.
There's not a week that goes by that one of his songs don't, like, just kind of end up in my head. And he's an example of, so he, in the 90s, he was very much involved in the kind of experimental rock scene. He had a band called Pelt. The story goes that he was getting interested in pre-war blues music and old ragtime music and the music of John Fahey and Robbie Basho. And he had a job at a coffee shop and he got fired because he wouldn't give a cup of coffee to a cop. And so instead of getting another job, he literally just spent like the next however months and year in just diving into solo guitar music. Mm-hmm. And not only studying the masters from a wide breadth of this tradition, but figuring out how he can make it his own. And so he put out this string of incredible records that span, that really span like the past of like pre-war blues, Indian ragas, and old-timey music, and he kind of like he made it all one thing. It was never one sound. It was never one like aspect of this guitar music. And right now we're listening to a song called Spirits in the House, which is from his self-titled record from 2006, which is a little bit after I got into him. But this was the record that like not only like turned me onto his music, but kind of like changed my worldview about how music could be.
Wow. You want to hear a little in the clear here?
Yeah.
Just the beginning of a 13-minute tune.
13-minute tune that picks up and swirls and goes into a different world. And, you know, as you can hear right now. And the thing is like, it'd be enough if his legacy would be secure if his music was already as beautiful and as challenging as it was. But the thing that, like, last year, a bunch of his records got reissued, and Laura Snapes, a freelancer that we work with, interviewed a bunch of musicians that he was friends with, that he influenced, about their favorite Jack Rose songs. And I want to read you one of the quotes from Nathan Bowles, who's in the band Black Twig Pickers, who did a record with Jack Rose, and makes his own music by his own right. But he basically said that Jack Rose was a sterling example of, quote, not being afraid or ashamed to throw yourself into the practice of the kind of music that you love. And he really didn't take anybody's bowl. He just made the music he wanted to make, and this was not cool music in the mid-2000s. I mean, this right now, this is from his final record, is released a month after he died, and it's old-time ragtime music, and it is the most joyful thing that I've ever heard in my life.
Jack Rose was 38, had a heart attack, rough.
Had a heart attack. Mm-hmm. It was a complete shock to everybody. He was a man that, like, from all stories that I've heard, he lived and played hard. And so maybe his heart just couldn't handle that life. But the one time I did see him perform live, I saw it. And I was like, I was blown away by his concentration, his determination for absolute perfection in the thing that he was making, which is why there are so many versions of the same songs that he had written over the years, because he was like, I can do this one better. I can, if I bring in this violinist, that'll be better. You know,
that's awesome. Jack Rose, that's Laura Scottridge talking about Jack Rose. Let's just quickly look at a couple of other things, sort of the lightning round here of great things that came out in 2009. Nate?
Well, you know, this wasn't a release, but one major event in 2009 that I remember was Leonard Cohen at the Beacon Theater.
That was an incredible show.
On this tour, right, where it's like he was this literally a monk. He was almost more of a rumor than a person at this point. And then he came back and not only began performing again, but seemed to have this incredible. It seemed like the act of performing was giving him this new life, this incredible generosity of spirit and enthusiasm on stage. And, you know, he was really connecting with the audience in a way that felt genuine, you
know? And his other musicians, he bowed, he knelt to the oud player, and it was just and took his hat off. It was just such a beautiful, elegant show.
You can listen to that show, in fact, on npr.org.
What else you got, Jacob?
I remember a bunch of things that came out that year, and you know, when we're thinking about that year being a great year for challenging indie rock, there was some good under-the-radar R&B and electronic music as well. The last great Mos Def record, The Ecstatic, came out that year. It was right in the middle of a stream of records by The Dream that were fantastic R&B records.
Oh, my gosh.
Can I say the name of this band? The record Tarot Sport by the electronic duo Fuck Buttons is just an incredible record that I listen to regularly still. The Mikachu and the Shapes record, first record, came out that year. One of my favorite singles of that decade, Big Boy's Shine Blockers with Gucci Mane, came out that year.
Was that 2009?
That was 2009,
oh,
man.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, there was a lot of good stuff.
We talked about folk and Jack Rose. A very sort of different folk was Laura Gibson's record came out in 2009 with the song Shadows on Parade that I madly loved. You know, the Decemberists, who were a band I dearly loved, who deal a lot with British folk music, put out The Hazards of Love, which I thought was a brilliant record and a mix of both British folk music and progressive rock music. There was an album by The Dry Spells that still is one of my favorite albums of all time. Also delved into that same place, and they just made the one album.
Fever Ray, Karen from The Knife, she released her debut solo album that year. And it's still something that I come back to often. And it's been incredible to hear her new music from this year called Plunge. And I'm still digesting that. Baroness put out Blue Record, which was, I really think, the high watermark for that metal band. Sun released Monolith in Dimensions, which was extremely adventurous for the metal scene. Theirs is a, you know, avant-garde metal duo with these giant, you know, feedback-strewn drone metal tracks, but they worked with like Julian Priester, the free jazz trombonist, worked with Avon Kang, the violinist, and he did all the choral and horn arrangements for the record. It forced the idea that metal should be taken as seriously as modern composition. And I also just want to say that that was the year that Glee premiered.
Oh my God.
Did you guys like Black Summer's Night, the Maxwell album?
Yeah, that was a good one too. The first of the trilogy that he has still yet to complete.
Right. Well, I mean, we've got two of them now.
Yes,
so that's you know, we haven't had to wait as long for the second one as we did for the first one.
And since I have my hands on the controls, and at the beginning of the show, you mentioned this Grizzly Bear. It was just a song that just seemed to, I heard it so much and I loved it so much. And I haven't heard it in years. So I'm going to listen to Go Out on 2 Weeks by Grizzly Bear. And thank you all for doing this.
That was the year that was.
Indeed.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.